This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 242. Today we speak about preaching and sermon preparation. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 242. My name is Camden Busey. I'm recording now from Wheaton, Illinois. New studio, and I've got boxes and boxes on top of each other going to fall on my head. But let me introduce to you our panel today from around the country. Introducing to you first, we have Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey, but he's serving as stated supply at Knox Presbyterian Church in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Jeff. It's good to have you back.
Oh, it is good to be here.
You've got quite the titles. it's like a whole paragraph of stuff. But that's good. Soon to be a doctor. He's a candidate at Westminster.
Lord willing.
Yeah, Lord willing. Finishing up his dissertation in the apologetics field, looking at Jonathan Edwards. I'm sure we'll talk about more of that in a moment. But first, let me introduce to you Nick Batzig, who is a church planter with the PCA. He's serving at New Covenant Presbyterian Church just outside of Savannah, Georgia, in Richmond Hill. Welcome back to the program, Nick. It's good to have you on again.
Thanks, Kim, and great to be on, and I appreciate you introducing me second and not last.
The new guy's got to come last. We got a pecking order here, you know. And I noticed on the church website, you can visit Nick at newcovpres.com, and it appears that he's releasing his sermons on vinyl now.
Yes. I wanted to be a little bit hipper, so I got that cool picture of the turntable there.
And it's, does the church have a Marantz tube amp to go with that
Just started doing dub for our meditative music right at the prelude. We have some dub playing.
Oh, man. Well, we're going to get even wilder here. We'll explain our topic here in a minute, but first I want to introduce to you a new panelist to Christ the Center. He's not going to be new to you soon as our new program East of Eden comes on board in a few weeks. I want to introduce to you David Filson, who's teaching pastor at Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the program, David. It's great to have you on.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here. And even though I'm third in the introduction, I am first in hipness. So
we just found out that Dave has a pair of seersucker skinny pants.
Yeah, they're not jeans. Yeah, they're skinny pants. And so he's being uber.
I can't say skinny jeans because they're seersucker.
Yeah, right. Uber culturally relevant.
And you can't call them skinny once I put them on because they just.
Oh, nice.
Brothers, you know, if David didn't already have a beard, he would have a soul patch.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, he has a soul patch. It's just accompanied by the rest of a beard.
That's true.
David is ministering there in Nashville. David, would you let people know a little bit about your studies at Westminster?
Yes, I'm a PhD student at Westminster. And
in Philadelphia.
I've focused for a long time on the work of Edwards, and I actually teach a course on Edwards for RTS Charlotte. But lately, my studies at Westminster have taken a turn, and I'll be focusing on J. Oliver Buswell and Cornelius Van Til. I was able to find some really, really neat things, correspondence between the two men, syllabi back and forth, annotated things, and I'm going to be exploring the debate between those two men. You know, obviously, people know a lot about the Clark-Van Til controversy. Buswell-Van Til is a rather understudied, underserved debate between those two men. It's quite instructive, I think.
That's fun. And David also has a blog, Teaching Like Rain, at teachinglikerain.wordpress.com, if you'd like to follow him online. And you got a Twitter account. What's your Twitter handle, just for people to know?
Just at David Owen Filson.
David Owen Filson on Twitter. Awesome. Well, we are delighted to have this group together, a friendly bunch. And today we're going to be doing an open forum. So it's a little bit different than usually we do interviews most often with authors of books or articles. But today we have no particular guest, but we're going to open up the discussion among us to talk about any important or pressing topics we might have or think questions that we have. And so hopefully this will be an opportunity to have kind of an unstructured discussion, and it, having this freedom allows for some things to be mentioned and spoken about that we don't get to in other programs. So hopefully you'll enjoy this, and I think it's going to be beneficial. But before we get started, I do want to mention that Christ the Center is listener supported. We rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and our viewers to help us to produce and distribute all of these Reformed resources free of charge. We love what we do, but we have expenses and costs, especially now that the studio's all been packed up in boxes and moved halfway across the country. We are incurring some expenses to get it back up and running the way we would like it, and we want to get into some new ventures. So please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate and pledge your support. We really rely on those monthly donations especially, and they're a big time help. Even as little as $5 a month can go a long way in helping us to get these resources into the hands of people around the world. So visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you for your support of everything we do at Reformed Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, gentlemen, before we open up our discussion, we should mention, since this is going to be released the same week we record it, any new books or any things we need to mention that our listeners might be interested in. Is there anything?
Two books related to Jonathan Edwards. One's called Jonathan Edwards and Justification, edited by Josh Moody, come out by Crossway. It looks into Edwards' treatment of the doctrine of justification. It's a nice little book. It's relatively short. And another book, which is an annotated version of Edwards' Charity and Its Fruits, has also come out. Edited by Kyle Strobel. Kyle has a chapter in the Edwards and Justification book as well. An up-and-coming Edwards scholar who has two more books in the pipeline on Edwards. So those are two books I'd highly recommend that our listeners get a hold of and devour for their spiritual benefit.
I'd also like to mention a new book by Graham Goldsworthy, Christ-Centered Biblical Theology, Hermeneutical Foundations and Principles. It's a recent book. I can't say that it came out in the last couple of weeks, but this year, and I don't know if we've mentioned it before. It might have come up once or twice, but certainly want to do maybe a detailed treatment of it in the future, but I've opened it up, and I've very much enjoyed what I've read so far. So many pastors, especially of the redemptive historical persuasion, will be very interested in this book, Christ-Centered Biblical Theology. Have you guys seen that one?
Who is that?
Graham Goldsworthy.
Oh yeah, yeah. I saw that was coming out.
Yeah, it's great.
I picked it up the other day. I've not really worked with.
Yeah, I heard it was good.
Yeah, it is. I've enjoyed. I've only read a couple chapters, but it's been great so far.
He has written, of course, many books on redemptive historical theology and preaching. This is a companion to his Christ-centered biblical hermeneutics, I believe.
Yes.
Similar art, cover art, and so forth. So it's a good follow-up. But almost anything by Graham Goldsworthy is going to be worth reading. There'll be differences between Goldsworthy and, say, a Gerhardus Voss or a Meredith Klein. However, he's very readable.
Yes.
And that is a benefit that we don't want to undersell. But he's connected with Moore Theological College in Australia.
Right.
Been an instructor there for years. I think he's retired now. Teaches as a retired professor, but very solid guy.
One thing I really appreciate with this volume, there's a lot of works on biblical theology. I mean, it's not limited to the Reformed community. I mean, it's
right.
Johann Gabler, I believe, is the one who kind of distinguished the discipline from systematics or dogmatic theology. But the thing about Goldsworthy, even though you might find some differences, I'd like to explore those in the future, from Voss and maybe Ritterboss and Klein, he works with them. I mean, so he's referenced them and footnoted them. And that's not always the case. You might find other evangelical works, even Calvinistic works on biblical theology that don't even footnote Voss. That's, being widely considered the father of Reformed biblical theology is kind of a sad state of affairs if you're not even working with him.
Right, agreed. And also, we ought to mention that G.K. Beale's Handbook on the New Testament Use of the Old Testament is coming out, I think, next month, very beginning of September. So that'll be probably a digestion of his actual full volume of the New Testament Use of the Old. And isn't he doing a handbook for his New Testament Biblical Theology, too? I'd heard that.
I don't know. Is this in that Zondervan series, or is this...
This is the one that's actually, I believe it's got similar cover art to the Biblical Theology of the New Testament.
Oh, the
it does,
Baker?
But it's a handbook of the New Testament Use of the Old, the big blue, the first big volume he published.
They're from Baker, right? With Carson.
He
edited.
This is just Beale, it looks like.
Excellent.
Okay. Yeah, it's just going to be Beale, and it'll be a Baker publication.
Okay, great. We'll look forward
to
that.
Another book that I think is worth mentioning, my friend Dr. Robert Peterson of Covenant Seminary, put this in my hands hot off the press last weekend, and it's the new book in the Explorations in Biblical Theology series. This was entitled Life Everlasting, The Unfolding Story of Heaven by Robert Peterson and Dan Barber, and it's newest book in that series, looking at the new heavens, the new earth, and conformity to Christ, glorification, just a biblical theology of heaven. Looks really good. I've read through some of it and interacts with Edwards here and there. So that's one the listeners might want to pick up.
Great. There's a lot of good things out there. My shelf is full of books I haven't read. It's better than the other way around because it means I've got some things to do. There's enough to already get us started, but I guess I'll let Jeff kickstart our open forum because I think he's got a topic to prime the pump with.
Absolutely. Just so the listeners know, we're within a couple of weeks of the release of the first episode of The East of Eden, the Biblical and Systematic Theology of Jonathan Edwards. Mm-hmm. We have now 9 episodes in the can, with a 10th in process of being scheduled. But as we were, as David and Nick and I were recording the 9th episode the other day, we began talking about how we go about preparing a sermon. When do we go about preparing a sermon? And these kinds of things. And I found it interesting that very often the way the minister goes about doing this will often be determined not merely by the methodology, say, taught in seminary or picked up by reading good books on sermon prep, but also it's determined in some ways by personality. Also probably by whether you have 1 or 2 sermons to prepare. But I found it an interesting conversation and thought that this would be a great one for us to talk about today. And Dave, your way of doing a little bit about me, and then you guys can respond. I'm in a position now where I have to preach twice on Sunday, and I'm grateful for that. That one of the privileges of now being stated supply is my feet are held to the fire, and I'm working on 2 new series that'll start, Lord willing, in September on the Gospel of John and on the prophet Ezekiel. Interesting combination of new and Old Testament. It will be challenging. I think Ezekiel may be more than John, although I may be surprised as I go through this. But my own method, some will say to you, do your translation and exegesis first and then go to the commentaries or listening to or reading other sermons. That's never been my method.
Really?
It's both. Because I'm reading commentaries all the time for my own personal devotional benefit. I'm reading God's Word. I'm now back to 5 chapters a day. That's just because I'm able to do it. And I read several verses from the Hebrew and the Greek. At some point, I want to do Hebrew, Greek, German, Dutch, and Latin. So I have one language 5 days a week. I haven't been able to do that because of my time constraints, but now I'm able to do that. But in terms of sermon prep, in one sense, the first thing I'm going to do is go probably to the English translation, just look through it, Then I'm going to print it. My practice has always been to go to Bible Works and print out the text of in the Greek or the Hebrew of the passage I'm going to translate.
Very good.
And then I would translate that, diagram and translate. But I can't say that I've ever purposed in my heart and mind to say I'm not going to look at anybody else until I've done that work, because it's not the way I work. I'll go to a commentary on John or Ezekiel as I'm doing that work.
Even on the first day, huh?
Yeah, even on the first day. It's just the way I am.
That's interesting.
And I think Nick and Dave would agree with me on that point, that it's not this is reflective, I think, of the hermeneutical spiral. And, of course, there's also works of systematic theology and biblical theology and church history. So all of these things are feeding into it, the process. And, frankly, I'm not interested in keeping these things hermetically sealed. My initial comment. Fire away.
Well, I think for our listeners' benefit, maybe explaining the hermeneutical spiral a little bit, that there are volumes written on what loci or what branch of theological science informs what. Does systematic precede biblical and exegetical, and is that the driving branch, or is exegetical the driving branch? And I think, as Jeff has noted, I've come to a position where I personally believe they're all mutually informing each other, and I don't want to give priority to any one over the other. I mean, my biblical theology corrects my exegesis at times, and my exegesis corrects my biblical and corrects my systematic, and my systematic guides my exegetical and biblical. So it's almost a fruitless question to say which comes first or which is more important. And I think it does affect our sermon prep, as Jeff has noted.
Well, I wonder whether that question is different from what I at least heard in Jeff's priming. Because, I agree with you that I think the disciplines inform one another. But for me personally, I prefer, as I open up a text and I'm starting to work through sermon preparation, I like to have a time where I'm struggling with the text on my own, knowing that I will eventually, of course, go into other resources, but I like to come at it fresh. Of course, I have some preconceived notions and things I've read in the past, but I like to open a text, work through the language, and struggle with it, and have that time where I'm really trying to fight to understand some of the difficult questions that might come up. Now, I might do exegetical, my exegesis, of course, but looking at it biblical, theologically, systematically. So I'm doing all the different things with the text that I ought to do. But yet I prefer to refrain for a while from going to commentaries or other biblical theological works or other systematic works to look at the text until I've felt that I've really wrestled with it on my own.
Yeah, this is actually how this conversation got started when we were talking, Dave, Jeff, and I the other day about this, because in seminary I had really had it beat into my head. You go to the text first, you don't go to the commentaries, you don't go to sermons, you just go to the text and you wrestle with it. And I actually abandoned that about a year and a half ago. I do my exegesis, I do work with the original languages, but I now go to an exegetical commentary, somebody I really respect. So, for instance, I'm preaching through 1 Corinthians, and, while he has some serious errors, I think, later on in his commentary, Gordon Fee, I find to be a very fine exegete. And so what I'll do is I'll read over his section, and the reason I do it is because I'm not smart enough to figure out all the possible exegetical interpretations out there on my own. I'd rather know they're out there before I come to the text and decide, okay, what does the exegesis teach?
But you might not have to decide at that time. What I'm saying is, for my own preference, I prefer to go in there and say, look, I've reached the end of it. I don't know how to treat such and such. And then when I turn externally, I start to see how other people are treating it. But if I've had that time to wrestle, I enjoy that, because then I feel like I have the freedom without, being colored originally to or predisposed towards a certain treatment of the text where I feel like I have the opportunity to really wrestle with something and treat it originally.
I understand that, yeah. And that you make a good point. However, my response to that is even if you read other scholars and their treatment of a passage in your wrestling, which I think all of us should be doing.
Right.
In your translation and in your interpretation, you'll be assessing what you've already read.
Indeed.
So it's not as if...
Oh, I know.
This is really, in many instances, this is more of... And some of this is determined by personality. So I don't want to be coming across saying this is the way it has to be done.
No, right. I don't think anyone's saying that.
The benefit of this discussion is that we are all wired differently, and I think Dave and I are probably we probably approach it a little bit more the same way from what we were saying the other day. And I don't think there's any one right way. I think it maybe was a mistake of professors to press on the guys, you have to do your own work first. As if you can come to the text in a vacuum. I mean, I'm already bringing a ton of theology to the text. Anytime I read the Bible, I'm bringing tons of paradigms that I've been... So this does get into the hermeneutical spiral issue, because we are bringing our systematic, our biblical, and even our conceptions of exegesis to our own study of the text. And so I have no problem going to outside sources to find out, okay, what's all out there? How have other men dealt with this? What scholarly articles are there? And then me going and making a final decision. Because I think at the end of the day, the only way the approach I take is dangerous for a guy is if he's not his own thinker. So, right. Camden, your point about you don't want to be leavened or colored by somebody else's. And I appreciate that, because a lot of guys are not their own thinkers, and they, mm-hmm. you know, they'll just side with the guy because I like this guy, or yeah, that makes sense, and they're not actually thinking, is that really what the text is teaching?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds like at the end of the day, or I guess I could say at the end of the week, we're nice. All sort of getting to the same place. We're just sort of taking different sort of trajectories. You know, for me, yeah, as we were talking the other day, you know, it sounded like Nick and I had some similarities on a couple of places. One probably was more personality driven, that of kind of waiting until, you know, Friday or Saturday to really bring it to its final form, which probably makes some listeners and some preachers very, very nervous just the very thought of that. But for me, and Nick, I think you were chiming in on this as well, that allows me to go into the pulpit on Sunday morning and the sermon being fresh, being very much a part of me, and I'm very, very much still in it. Sort of existentially, and it gives me a certain energy. Whereas if I have the sermon wrapped up Tuesday or Wednesday and it's written and it's just waiting to be preached, I lose a certain, I don't know, sense of energy, a sense of ethos with it. You know, as far as preparation, for me, the thing that I begin with is a really close reading of the English text, really get the English text, you know, in me, even for a couple of days, and I'll know, you know, enough ahead of time that I can have a couple of days even before the week begins to really have that passage in English sort of become a part of the warp and woof of my being. And I think about the English text, and then I start thinking about an outline, a structure on the basis of that, and I'll read it in the Greek as well, just not detailed exegetical work.
Right, right.
Translating as I read. So I'll do both English and Greek. Then I will, as you were saying, Nick, I'll find a technical commentary just to sort of get the options, the exegetical options in my head, and I'll sort of let that get thrown into the mix. And so this is sort of like, you know, I don't know, sort of like when I make my chili, I just start throwing things in with no rhyme or reason and just see what's tasting good as I go along and what I need to add and what I need to leave off. But
right.
The thing that I do not miss at this point, if I'm doing something in the New Testament, I mean, this is the sine qua non of my sermon preparation now. I will not preach a New Testament text until I have early on in the process, before I have started writing or even before I've done a lot of commentary work, I will look at Carson and Bill's New Testament use of the Old and Bill's New Testament biblical theology. And I'll tell you, I have found the latter, especially New Testament biblical theology, to simply be cash money from a homiletic perspective. I don't know that I ever want to preach a New Testament text without consulting that volume. And it's obviously not like a commentary as such on Romans or a commentary on Galatians or what have you, but I've just found it to be invaluable for my sermon prep.
I think also picking up on what you said about reading the English, and I know, Jeff, you made this point already, and Camden, you did, and Dave, that you do have to know, we have to be familiar with the text before we go to anything. So I appreciate the whole spending time reading it, studying it for yourself, and I hope every minister does that first and foremost. Mm. But also knowing the argument of the book, and I know that sounds very fundamental, but I mean, I'm always asking, what does this have to do with what just went before, or what I just preached? You know, and I do that even before a series. I mean, I'll read through the book and really know the argument of the book and look for common themes and connections and resurfacing language. You know, like 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Paul's constantly talking about insufficiency and weakness and, you know, life in the spirit versus life in the flesh, you know, trusting God versus trusting gifts, you know, all those themes that kind of go through there. And then, but then when I come to a text really saying, okay, is this a new break, or is this intimately related to what the argument's been? What's the flow? What's the kind of the brook or the stream of the book? Because I think that gives me more impetus in sermon prep than anything, is really seeing that text in context. What goes before? What comes after? How does this fit into the main argument? I know that's very basic, and you guys all know that, but that's huge for me in sermon prep.
Mm-hmm.
Remember in our conversation, we also brought up Moise Silva's article. I think it was originally in the Westminster Journal and then got published in a couple different books. It appears, I think, in Revelation and Reason. David, do you remember the title of that?
Yeah, it's A Case for Calvinistic Hermeneutics. It actually, the first book it appeared in was the case for biblical hermeneutics. It was a Zondervan publication that Silva and I believe Kaiser did, and this was back in, goodness, 94, 95, is where that essay first appeared. But again, that essay is golden and talks about, as we were alluding to earlier, the fact that none of us come to exegesis with sort of an exegetical tabula rasa. You know, we're bringing our system, and that's a good thing. Obviously, we don't want to be presumptuous with our systems and so forth, but it's a good thing that we're bringing it, and it's just a great article.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you guys listen to sermons in sermon prep?
I do.
Who do you listen to?
Sinclair Ferguson.
Yep.
Depends on what's available. Sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. Lloyd Jones.
I mean, I have about four or five go-to guys, and if they have a sermon on it, like Sinclair, Eric Alexander, William Still, all the British guys, Lloyd Jones,
Right. Those
are the guys I look for. Ian Hamilton, Edward Donnelly, those are like the go-to guys off the bat, and 9 out of 10 times, one of them is going to have a sermon series, an expositional series. I find that very helpful because, I mean, these men have done a tremendous amount of work. They're some of the finest, you know, pastor, preacher, theologians of our age. And man, I feel like I'm learning from the greatest. We're so blessed to have them. I mean, it would almost be like living in the Puritan era and, you know, as a young Puritan minister early on, being able to listen to William Perkins every week or, you know, Thomas Watson preaching. I mean, we are so unbelievably blessed.
Mm-hmm.
It really is an embarrassment of riches available to us. I mean, I remember, you know, goodness, back in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, when I was first doing a lot of teaching and preaching in a Reformed context. And back then, you know, you had to get catalogs and order tape series and wait for them to convert. And, you know, now, you know, the problem is trying to figure out how do you best use your time with everything that is a mouse click away?
It's a filtering problem. Yeah.
It's a filtering problem. But Ferguson for me is always go to. As far as other sermons, I read Lloyd Jones, I read Spurgeon. I mean, Spurgeon is always, I mean, he's just such a spicy meatball to begin with. And there's always something choice, some choice morsel that you can, you know, adapt or quote or whatever. So
I know I'm noticing a food theme with you today.
Yeah. By the way,
chili
by the
and
way.
Spicy morsels and
exactly. By the way, Camden,
come to Nashville.
You're not going to get in those skinny pants anymore.
I said, since I put them on, they're no longer skinny.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, Jeff.
Remember, this is how David preaches. You have to go online to his church website and hear him. This is totally natural. How he's interacting with us today. His preaching is great. Now, Nick, you mentioned in your sermon prep that you always or almost always go to the Jonathan Edwards Center and do a search by the scripture reference, right?
Yeah, I put up on Feeding on Christ, if you click on the resources tab, not the drop down, you know, subcategories, but on resources, I put a link to the three kind of sermon or, you know, search resources that I use regularly, and the WJE Online is a big one, because if you just type in 1 Corinthians 9, for instance, it'll give you every reference of everything they have, and they have almost the complete works online now, and it's very helpful. I found wonderful quotes and expositions, very helpful thoughts. I find that to be really good for sermon illustrations, just to say, you know, Jonathan Edwards thought about this, or, you know, just as a kind of a filler for the sermon. And so that's a great resource. And then the PCA Historical Center and Wayne Sparkman has done a great job of pulling together a reference, sermon reference list of, according to scriptural reference, historically reformed sermons, lots of Spurgeon, lots of Puritan stuff on each text. So you could go, if you're preaching through Romans 5, you would see what all he's put up there. And then you could go to Google Books or Internet Archive, and almost without exception, you find the sermon somewhere online. So those are two really big resources I use. Do you use Jonathan Edwards stuff much, Jeff, in your sermon prep?
I do. And as you say, it's very helpful. It'll sometimes clear up ambiguities in the text, or it'll offer good ways of saying something, memorable ways of putting things. Now, of course, Edwards wrote 250 some years ago, so the language will be somewhat archaic, but you can rephrase things, but still there's a sense in which you're learning from a great mind. There are times where you disagree with Edwards' interpretation, and you and we, the three of us who've been involved with the recording of East of Eden, have recently had a couple of occasions where we've disagreed with Edwards. You remember that from a couple days ago,
sure.
where we took exception to Edwards' handling of a few passages, and that, of course, is the whole point of it too. Is you have a conversation partner, not infallible. Only the Bible is infallible, not any of the preachers who preach the Bible, or the commentators who comment on the Bible.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the great things about Edwards, and especially the online works there, you know, you have the search filter that's canonical. You can go on and very easily just go through a canonical list of his sermons. But one of the benefits of, I think, consulting Edwards from a homiletical perspective, and I think this is maybe something that folks not entirely familiar with Edwards, or maybe folks who've only read some of the more philosophical treatises will not be aware of, and it's that when you read his sermons, you are going to be aided greatly from a biblical theological standpoint. I mean, it's kind of like when I said I always want to go consult Bill's New Testament biblical theology, because it really heightens my biblical theological awareness and gets my radar going for that. Edwards is the same way, and we noticed that in several of his sermons in our recording thus far, and especially with the Pure in Heart. Nick, you'll recall how you just drew out, and both of you guys, Jeff and Nick, drew out all of that biblical theological paradigm at the beginning of the Pure in Heart, blessed. But that really is why we had the idea of doing East of Eden to begin with. And getting back to the food theme, the impetus, really what gave birth to that whole podcast concept, was a Philly cheesesteak that Jeff and I were enjoying up in Flowertown, Pennsylvania. You remember that, Jeff?
Yeah, Mr. P.
So, exactly. But there's just a lot of good biblical theological awareness that can be mined from Edwards, and that maybe is something that that people aren't aware of with him.
Wow. Yeah. I wanted to ask you guys, too, because I know all of you do quite a bit of scholarship and scholarly study. Do you use online journals and scholarly articles in sermon prep at all? Do you like go to galaxy.com or any of these other sites or use Logos to search Westminster Theological Journal or JETS or any of that?
Atlas. Atlas is nice, too. You know, you get a lot of the scholarship, and you can do searches by text there to find out pretty much any theological article that's been indexed, which is almost any serious publication.
Right. Yeah, I do that a lot, and I find that to be, you know, that's where the strenuous work of mental preparation really, besides the exegetical that you do on your own, but, you know, it takes a lot of mental work to really, you know, push yourself through the scholarly articles that are much more nuanced. But I find that helps my understanding of the text a whole lot more when you really get into one of the more difficult, because usually those articles will be like, for instance, this week I did the text, 18 verses that included, "You shall not muzzle an ox while he treads out the grain." And so there were one or two articles, Kaiser and somebody else, that did an article on Paul's use of Deuteronomy there. And, you know, that's not technically me studying the text, but it really helps me a lot in preaching better the text to understand that nuanced difficulty.
The trick is always to, Vern Poitras is always keen on saying you need to bring people the bread, not the bread factory. And I love getting into the details there, and you need to wrestle with some of those things because they're going to point out difficulties to you that, you know, even many commentaries might miss. And oftentimes the good commentaries are dealing with the scholarship. If you note, a lot of the things that they work with are these articles. But, you know, commentaries, even the best, might be 10 years old or 20 years old. And so the articles are a lot more fresh or fresher, a lot more up to date. But the danger is making sure that the sermon doesn't turn into a lecture a dispensal of information.
This is where, in my experience now, the three Sundays of preaching two sermons, some of that, the application which a sermon has to have, okay, personal application, I believe a sermon must have. But, of course, the application has to be guided by, directed by the text itself and the biblical theological background. However, some of that I do, the application is not in my notes. And that's a whole nother discussion. Do you go into the pulpit with a manuscript with a detailed outline, a minimal outline, or no outline? I believe Dave and Nick, you go with no outline, right? You've read yourself full, and then you're going to deliver God's word, and it's got a freshness to it. My approach is different. Now, of course, now that I'm having to preach twice every Sunday, this may change. But in the past, the sermon has typically been done the week before, and that allows me that week to read through the sermons again and again every day so that it gets into me, so that it's not something that I read, but it's something I proclaim.
Indeed.
Yeah, what I think I typically do is I'm formulating the sermon, say, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, just, you know, in my head. I'm just verbalizing it as I'm driving, I'm working on things, I'm trying out illustrations, I'm trying out, literally just vocalizing certain things. People probably think I'm strange, like I'm talking to myself, but I do that. Typically, then on Thursday and Friday, I will write out the sermon as a manuscript, just, you know, write it out. And on Saturday, and this is what I'm talking about, kind of waiting to the weekend, it would probably make some folks nervous. Maybe some folks, this just wouldn't work out for them, just because of the exigencies of time or whatever. But on Saturday, I'll take the manuscript that I've typed out, and I will take one, and I limit myself to one legal size piece of cardstock, and I handwrite the notes. And I do the notes in color coding, because by the time I write it out, and by the time I get in the pulpit, I have the sermon basically memorized, so that what I'm looking at in the pulpit, I'm not actually reading anything. I'm looking at blocks of color-coded sections. So, for instance, all my exegesis and explication of the text is in blue. All of my quotations and illustrations are in red, and all of my application is in green. So that if I see as I'm going through and I'm looking at blue, I know where I am in the sermon text, given, you know, the fact that I've memorized it and I've rehearsed it, and I'm just explaining the text. Then I can look down and see red. I don't actually read the illustration or the quotation. I just know, okay, this is the first red block, and I know what quotation is there. Or I look down and I see green. Of course, green means go, and it's like, you know, go and apply this. So that works for me. I'll also use other colors. Like, I'll write something out in orange if it's something that doesn't really fit any of those categories, but I don't want to forget it. But looking at on a Sunday morning, it is really a bunch of chicken scratch, but it's in colored blocks, and it cues my memory. That works for me. Probably sounds like craziness to y'all.
No.
It's a mnemonic device. Yeah.
Yeah. I've done the same thing. Yeah.
I think this is where it's so nice. The more I talk to guys like you and other pastors and professors, that everybody's so different. Uh-huh. And I like the freedom that we have to do this stuff differently. Like, I write out, you know, I'll write out quotes, I'll write out a few applications. I definitely write out an outline just so I know that outline. But then I force myself to basically memorize everything. And it's a lot more work for me to really have to do that. And I think I do it last minute. You know, I do just what you guys probably do, and kicking around, working on it early in the week and thinking about it through the week. But I do the hard work, like you, Dave, at the end of the week, so that I am just full with the knowledge of the text, the applications I want to make. I've preached it to myself. I've been meditating on it personally, so that when I come up there, I have to know that stuff. And the reason I preach without notes is because I could never preach with a manuscript, Jeff. We've talked about this. Like,
right.
You preach good with a manuscript. You know, you do very well with a manuscript. I don't know how I'd do it. I mean, I'd feel like I was reading to people. So, wow. I don't know how to preach with a manuscript, so I preach without notes. And I remember in seminary, one of my homiletics prof telling the guys, like, almost like making an example of me, like, they should try to do it more like that. And I don't appreciate that now, because as I look back, I know a number of guys that preach very competently with a manuscript. And so I like the freedom that we're all different, right? And,
yeah. Right.
I use a manuscript. I would also encourage people to look at Matt Cotta's article in Ordained Servant, where he writes about manuscript preaching. And he's not saying everyone should do it by any stretch, but he's also defending the use of it. And there's this strong swell of people that are just thoroughly, dogmatically opposed to manuscript preaching. Yeah. But if, you know, I use a manuscript, but I use it as a form of extended notes. Like, I'm looking the people in the eye, you know, and if it's done well, people wouldn't even know that you're using a manuscript.
Right.
The problem becomes, I think, you know, when you see, especially younger preachers who are dependent upon a manuscript, and they make a, you know, they either make a big show of turning their pages or whatever, and that can become somewhat distracting. And I think,
or they misread. Sometimes they misread,
exactly.
Which is, that's a struggle. You have to write, if you're going to use a manuscript, you have to write it for the spoken word. You have to practice it thoroughly. You have to format it in a way where you can look up and down without losing your place, using headings, indentations, all sorts of things. I make my paragraphs very short, and I know what's in the paragraph. Usually I can see the first two words, and then for me, I don't have to read the paragraph. I just speak it.
You speak, but, yeah, because you know what.
I know what's in there. But you know, if I but it's all there if I need it, you know, word for word, if I need
it. Right. In one sense, I use a manuscript myself, even though I don't take a manuscript into the pulpit, because I've written a manuscript and I've memorized that manuscript, and I've created this color-coded
key. you're doing a similar thing. So it's similar
to what you're saying there, because you know what's in those sections.
Right.
There's a benefit, I think, to preaching without notes, and it was the only benefit I would say that you really have, besides the ability to connect with the people entirely, is that I love the freedom that I have in extemporaneous preaching, where every week God is putting something in my mind while I'm preaching that I didn't plan on saying, or using something that I'll just, it's almost like you're running through a field and then all of a sudden you see something, you just pick it up as you're going.
You see, I do that too, though. Yeah, I mean,
right. Yeah, you can do it with the manuscript. I just love that freedom of, and afterwards somebody will say, that was really powerful when you said this. And I'll say, you know what? I wasn't even planning on saying that. That was the Lord, you know, who gave me that at that moment. And I know that sounds a bit mystical, but I do think there's a principle. Thomas Boston wrote a sermon on, it may have been Goodwin actually, on, don't worry about what you're going to say or speak in that hour. It'll be given to you. And that's not an excuse, obviously, for not doing the hard sermon prep, but there is something really wonderful. And like you said, Kim, it can happen when you use a manuscript, but there's something wonderful about the freedom of, I remember Joey Piper once said, you do your sermon prep as if it's entirely up to your preparation, and then you try to forget that you've prepared. That's a kind of a strange way of putting it, but I get a little bit more of what he means by that.
I think he's right. Yeah.
You don't trust in your preparation.
Right. You know, it's interesting thinking about preachers that we're familiar with. Ligon Duncan does a full manuscript prep, but then I believe he goes into the pulpit with an outline. Some years ago, I had some email conversation with him, and he shared with me the steps. He emailed me copies of the steps from the manuscript to the brief outline. John Stott, I believe, said that he prepared a manuscript but didn't bring the manuscript into the pulpit.
Right.
Rick Phillips preaches, he told me, from a full manuscript. And so it really depends upon the personality, the skill, the comfortability. And so I think we do best to avoid, in a sense, spiritualizing this particular matter. In other words... It's not a matter of, well, so and so is more spiritually mature because they have no notes.
Right.
I agree with you, Nick. For me, years ago in another life, in another denomination, I found, because I had read, and I forget where I read it, that a person who brings a full manuscript but who reads a lot, and we should all be in that category, but who reads a lot would tend to read their manuscript. And I found that was true for me.
Oh, that's interesting.
So years ago, I decided to dispense with the manuscript. And very often I had an index card. That's all I had. Good or bad, that's what I did.
Right.
And then when I came to Westminster, I got back into doing the manuscript. And then at some point, I think in conversations with you and Jim Cassidy and Camden with you, I think I decided, okay, let me see if I can dispense with the manuscript without a loss of content, without a loss of content.
Right.
And Jim's not a manuscript fan at all.
Well, he's gone back and forth on that.
Really?
And so what I did was I tried this. I made a break with the full manuscript where I was guests of supplying the pulpit in one congregation in fact, it was Mark Herzer's church, Christ Covenant PCA in Warminster, PA. One Sunday I used a manuscript, the next Sunday I used an outline, and I asked for some feedback, and they actually couldn't tell the difference. Now, I don't, you know, you wonder whether that was good or bad. They meant it, I believe, as an encouragement.
Right.
And since then, so for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, I've not gone with a manuscript, and there is a freedom as I'm preaching. I try to gauge whether people are tracking with me, and if I sense, it's not infallible, but if I sense that there's a loss of comprehension, I will backtrack and try to clarify as I go along. And that's one of the things that now you could have a manuscript and do that, but you have to be comfortable with departing from the manuscript. And I think, Camden, that's what you've been saying, is that you're comfortable in the pulpit with departing from stepping away, right?
Yeah.
And coming back. You step away and you come back
all the time. Yeah.
I wanted to just, before we run out of time, open up the discussion for our listeners' sake of how we do, how we bring Christ into the text, because I know that's, you know, a hot button issue, and you have the Dale Ralph Davis is saying he's not under every verse, like, you know, he's under every rock, and all these little catchy, I'm not really even sure, you know, who thinks it's under every word and every verse, but I at least wanted to give my two cents, and then I want to hear from you guys, because mm-hmm. this is big for me. I swore as a young Christian that if Paul said, I determined not to know anything among you but Jesus Christ and Him crucified, that I would make that a mark of my ministry, that I really believe the gospel has to be in every sermon. And I know there's, you know, hundreds of ways that that happens. There's almost a gospel fluency that guys adopt after a while from their own personal need for Christ. And but, you know, we do weekly communion at New Covenant, and I love that. I don't think the Bible mandates it necessarily, but I think we're free to do that, and it's good. And that forces me to have to tie the sermon into the supper every week without being you know, painfully repetitious or cheap. And so I'm always thinking, okay, I'm meditating on it after the sermon, during the supper, what I'm going to say even further. And that always helps me, because when you have to do that with the supper and tie the sermon in, you are automatically, and Voss makes a great point, and I forget, it's a sermon in Grace and Glory, and I forget which one it is, but he talks about somewhere how the purport of the supper and the purport of our preaching ought to be one and the same. Mm-hmm. And that, so the supper, in a sense, prepares us for how we ought to be preaching the gospel out of the text. So if we can do it for the supper, why can we not do it with the text? And obviously, it's easier with the New Testament epistles, because, I mean, I think if you look for the word Christ or gospel or a theme like you were bought with a price or anywhere in Peter and Paul and John, you're going to find the gospel in almost every text. But in the gospel narratives and in the Old Testament, that's where it's a lot harder, right? Because it's not as explicit, and that's where the biblical theology has to come in. So like that Edwards sermon we just did, where Jesus is on the Sermon on the Mount, he's on the Mount of Olivet, and he's saying, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Well, you know, the overly systematic preacher is just going to take that and preach about purity in heart and what it is and what it means to see God, and he's not going to preach the gospel out of it generally. But the biblical theological pastor is going to see that in the biblical theological context of Moses on the mountain praying to see God's glory, Jesus on the mountain. What, how can we get a pure heart? What happens when we're not pure in heart? You know, and that's always going to take us to the cross. Why is Jesus there? Where is he heading? How does he enable this? What do we do when we fail? Those kind of questions, I think. Is that how you guys kind of approach things?
It's how I do. I mean, as you already alluded, Edwards begins his sermon on the pure in heart actually with Moses on Sinai, then Jesus on Mount Olivet with the Sermon on the Mount, then Jesus in the Mount of Transfiguration, right? And remember how I noted there's the mountain typology going on in the background of Edwards' sermon. And of course, those of us who are familiar with Edwards' methodology of interpreting God's word will know that he was big into typology, which is the major element of biblical theology. And yes, I will go on record as saying that every sermon that I preach has to include Christ in there. And I, Lord willing, I do it not forcibly, but because naturally the text leads there. And of course, Jesus said that in Luke 24 to the disciples on the road to Emmaus. So we've got biblical, basis warrant. For doing it. Yeah, biblical warrant.
Absolutely.
And Camden, any thoughts that you have on that?
Yeah, this comes back to the, you know, discussion that has cropped up from Peter Enns with his insistence on the word Christotelic. And I disagree with his use of it, but the kernel of his concern is important, I think. And sometimes people can treat the text or treat Christocentric preaching in a very cheap or artificial way, where it's almost like the people sitting in the pew are just waiting to see, well, he's going to pull Jesus out of a hat. How is he going to do it this week? And
right.
And that's not appropriate. But what we need to see is that Christ is the goal, the telos. That's what Enns was getting at, that end point at which the text is driving at. Now, I think Christocentric is still a good word that we can use. I mean, our show is called Christ the Center. I hope it's still a good word we can use. But the thing is, we need to do this organically. We need to understand the trans-testamental gospel. We need to understand that Christ is the fulfillment. He's the solution. He's the good news. And so if we're preaching a psalm, you know, maybe one that's not, you know, they're all about Christ, but maybe one that's not apparent, like Psalm 88, for instance, which is not very uplifting, but it's a psalm that kind of ends on a, the whole thing is kind of depressing, but it gets to the point of the human condition and our plight, our struggle, in sin and our reality, the difficulties of daily life. Now, there's a very great opportunity to bring in Christ, but in an organic way, you know, how the gospel comes to reach us in our daily lives.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be this kind of magical trick you do in the last 5 minutes of the sermon, but it should develop organically, or I should say naturally, from the questions that arise from the text, I think.
Yeah. I think if you make it a habit of all waiting the last couple of minutes of the sermon to take them to Christ, then it could become almost gimmicky in the ears of our hearers. And so I think truly Christocentric preaching is going to be truly Christotelic in the true sense of the word. The end point is to be Christ, because all along has been Christ. I mean, it's like, what, you know, to live as Christ, die as gain. The reason to die as gain is because to live as Christ to begin with. And so if we're going to end with Christ in preaching, it's going to be because we've been preaching him throughout the entirety of the sermon. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this can become forced at times and so forth. But I'm like you, Nick. I don't know of anyone who finds Christ under every verse. I don't even know what that means. I think if we allow the Bible to be balanced as the Bible is balanced, it is going to be Christocentric, and our preaching is going to be Trinitarian.
Well, I think that's why that under every word thing is kind of points to that kernel of concern between centric and telic. The caricature of centric is that he is, just take this word out, whether it's a gar or a ha, the definite article there, this is, pull it, there's Christ. But we got to ask also, and if we look at it from a different perspective, why is that word there, even if it is a single word? I mean, it goes to serve the meaning of a sentence, it serves the meaning of a paragraph, serves the meaning of an argument, of an entire book, etc. All the words in the Bible are inspired by God, and they're all there to point us to the triune God, to drive us to Christ, to understand our needs. So it's kind of a matter of perspective. I don't want to sound perspectival, but in the sense of why is any single word there for the purpose of Christ? But does that mean that single word there is just straight line shot, like in an artificial way to Jesus? Well, no, we have to develop and understand what the text is getting at and see how it drives us to Christ, it drives us to Christ.
Right. Yeah, and I think, Camden, I appreciated you bringing up the Psalms, because the Psalms are particularly difficult and more than other parts of the Old Testament, I think, because when we study how the apostles quote the Psalms, and they do it in a very Christ-centered way, where, especially I think of Hebrews chapter 1 and, all over, really, the book of Acts is loaded with Christological citations out of the Psalms and expositions and how these were relating to the Messiah to come. But then when you go into the Psalms, we realize that like Psalm 2 is probably exclusively about Jesus and not about David and Jesus. But then, there are Psalms that are David's experience. I don't think all of them are David's experience typifying Christ. I think some are prophetical. A guy named Binney has a great book on this. Guy named Binney has a book called something about the Psalter, and goes through the different categories, how some psalms are all about Christ, some psalms are in some parts about David, like when he prays for forgiveness of sin. That's not about Jesus, that's about David. But then the apostles will quote something out of one of those psalms and apply it to the historical and redemptive historical life of Jesus. And so some of that psalm may be about Christ, one or two verses in that psalm, or it may be all prophetical, or it may be about David as a type of Christ. So, you have to work hard to understand the apostolic use of the psalms and the genre of the psalms and the historical settings. So it's not easy, right?
No. It's a challenge, but that's part of the sermon prep is a spiritual discipline for the preacher. The message that you proclaim to the people is one that you've already proclaimed to yourself, because you stand under the word. We're not over the word. We're under the word. We're servants of the word, not masters. And therefore, when we step into the pulpit, we've already exposed ourselves to the teaching of the passage that we're going to proclaim. And we may get a dose of it again, even as we're in the pulpit. We may become convicted by the passage that we're preaching.
We should step into the pulpit, I think, with the sense, the palpable sense, that we have just dealt with something bigger than ourselves that week in the text. And so there is a certain burden and a certain sense of, you know, I have worked hard. I have labored. It's been a labor of love, but I've labored. And that is an energizing thing, to be sure. But, yeah, it needs to happen during the week. And then, yeah, Jeff, happening in the pulpit, you know, we get another dose of it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, gentlemen, we might have to close up shop. I know David's got a meeting to get to. And we got some – I think we've had a pretty full discussion. Are there any final closing remarks we want to say or to tie this all up?
But just one thought, and that is that this is a glorious work. It has its challenges and its frustrations. But it is – I'm speaking for myself, and I believe I'm speaking for all of us here, that this, along with the other aspects of ministry – are a glorious work. We are not sufficient for these things, and therefore we must always rely upon the Father, the work of Christ, the person of Christ, and the ministry of the Holy Spirit. These things we are absolutely reliant upon. Even with the best preparation, it is only as the Holy Spirit takes that and brings it home that it will have its intended effect.
Mm.
Amen.
Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate that. Of course, we can follow up on this discussion. Please comment online if you visit us at reformedforum.org. This episode should be at /CTC242. So comment, and we'd love to chat more about this online. If you'd like to visit all the gentlemen, you can find David at christprez.org. And also, what was the link to the blog, David?
Teaching like rain,
yeah.
wordpress.com.
Also, Nick's at newcovepres.com. Jeff and Nick both write at feedingonchrist.com. And Jeff is at calvary-amwell.org. You can find more information about what I'm up to as well. I should mention that I'm at Wheaton, not just because I moved here on my own accord, but I'm serving Bethel OPC here in Wheaton. They're at betheloPC.org. I'm a year-long intern. So if you're in the area, I'd love to meet you. Stop by for services. We got morning and evening services. It's a really great church, and I'm really been blessed to get to know these people, and it's going to be a good time here. So stop by if you're able, right here on Naperville Road in Wheaton, Illinois. And I should mention also for the Illinois people that I think the Binny that Nick was mentioning is not the Binny of Binny's Beverage Depot. But
that's correct. That is correct.
But
although I might visit that.
Anyway, both are superb in their own way. And of course, we're online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our resources. We've got a lot of great stuff coming up. It's a great time in our organization's life, and we're really excited to bring to you the new show, the new program, I should say. It's not a show, it's a program. East of Eden, as well as we got some really exciting things in the works. So stay tuned to the website, reformedforum.org. And if you would like to get a hold of us, you can tweet us at Reformed Forum or email us at mail@reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.